Data Report. By the way, you can follow us. You can hear the these broadcasts be available at Facebook/The Taylor Report, and I urge you to, if you want to keep track of all these issues that our program has been following, we're available, and usually by Thursday, I'm proud to say. I want to mention that, of course, we're going to talk about Syria with Ava Bartlett, and Ava Bartlett has a site in Gaza.wordpress.com. And she has her most recent article about the situation in Syria in dissidentvoice.org, and that was published on December 29, featured a report on her visit to places in Syria which were celebrated Christmas. And you'd think that that would be a headline story in the West, particularly at Christmas time, and everybody's talking about Islam, and they're talking about all the crisis, and they're claiming to be, you know, that they're talking about sectarians, that they're struggling against people with a really bizarre approach, and people who hate other, not only other religions, but hate other schools of Islam, and yet. We didn't get any coverage of that, but that's why we're talking, I hope, with Eva Bartlett. Are you there? Eva, how are you?
I am, Phil. Hi, how are you?
Very good. Let's remind our listeners that you have lived in Gaza, you have lived in Lebanon, you've traveled to Syria, I think, is it four times since 2014 you've been there?
That's right, yes.
So if anybody's qualified, you are. And by the way, you're just freshly returned.
Yes. And yes, I just spent 8 days in Syria. It was rather unexpected, but I was in Lebanon for a conference on Palestine, and I was issued a journalist visa, so I took the opportunity to go to Syria.
Well, we're really glad you did. We wish it was more honest journalists and courageous journalists who would go there, because so much of what we read, is very hard to understand what's taking place. You chose for the article most recent in Dissident Voice, something I thought would really resonate, certainly if they'd done it properly here, it would have. You attended or saw Christmas celebrations in places that had been occupied by these people called ISIS or whomever, the various terrorist groups. That must have been for you a remarkable experience.
Well, what was interesting, this was my third time to Homs, the first time being in April 2014, with a peace delegation. And at that time, the terrorist factions were still embedded in the old city. So, you know, there were places you could go in Homs, but obviously it wasn't possible to go to the old city. Shortly after, it was liberated, and in June, when I returned on a journalist visa, I was able to go to the old city. And it was, as you would expect, you know, devastation, from the terrorists themselves, you know, setting booby traps before they left, or any of the extreme damage and vandalism they did while they were there, including specifically targeting any sort of Christian sites, churches, homes with Christian icons, etc. But now, a year and a half later, although there's still a tremendous amount of rebuilding to be done, there has actually been some building. People have come back. I mean, not everybody, of course. It's less than 50% of the population that have come back to the old city. But shops have opened, and yes, there were, even in, for example, this restaurant that had been very badly damaged, it was open and serving customers, and it had Christmas decorations, and there were decorations in the streets. And later, friends from Homs sent me images of what it was like on Christmas Day. And, you know, I think most people would be surprised to see that these churches, like St. Mary's Church that was burned out by the terrorists, was functioning again, and it was packed with people who were celebrating Christmas.
Yeah, and you have a picture of a Christmas tree. Could you tell it accompanies your article in dissonantvoice.org. Tell us... Well, one, did you take the picture? What is that picture?
Yeah, it's a tree. tree in this old city of Damascus now. So I've spent a lot of time in the East Quarter, or the East Gate Quarter, Bab Sharki. I stayed in a simple hotel there, and this time I was there again, and it was interesting. In that instance, I had just been talking with one of the local national defense soldiers that, you know, was an example of soldiers throughout Syria, everyday people who have decided, you know, taken training and taken up weapons to defend their countries. And this particular man was a Christian man from the area, and just before I saw this tree, he was telling me about comrades and friends and loved ones he'd lost. Not only fighting the terrorists, but also from the terrorist mortars that they rained down all over Damascus, but particularly, especially hard in the old city. So after having talked with him and seen a simple nativity scene display that he and some others from the neighborhood had put up using their own money just to bring some happiness to the kids in the area and to the people, then I walked down a few hundred meters, and just at this one church, there's a Christmas tree decorated, but when you look closer, it has the images of martyrs from that area. So these are people that have been either killed while fighting the terrorists or, again, by the mortars.
It's a wonderful photograph. It tells so much in just one picture, and I congratulate you on that. The other thing, you know, you brought in, you interviewed a priest from Holland, I believe. And, again, I noticed that here we are. We live in this case, Canada. And in Western countries, which too, Christmas is a big thing. And of course, in our media, it's, we have to fight ISIS, the Islamic extreme, blah, blah. Yet they don't listen at all to such figures as that priest that you met, who, if he were interviewed, he could easily tell people in the West what they need to know. But
I need to clarify a point. Now, there was a Dutch priest, and that might be who you're thinking of, Father Frans van der Loot, but he was assassinated by the terrorists shortly before Old Homs was liberated. And he had been living there for decades, and he was well-loved by Syrians, and he was actually rather impartial in that, like, he wasn't taking sides, but he did keep he wrote articles and wrote, I think, a blog. And he's noted for having said, from the beginning, there were armed people in the protest. From the beginning, there was terrorism amongst these so-called nonviolent protesters. And then he was later assassinated. The priest that I interviewed was from Homs. He happened to be in Damascus for the day. And he was talking about how the terrorism was affecting Christians.
Yeah. It is remarkable, isn't it, that the church voices are not being echoed by their fellow churchmen here. It's like there's only one position. There's a terrible government in Damascus, and we have to fight it, and then we have to fight ISIS. But there are people who've been living there who would be identifiable and culturally and in every other way, who you would think that if they were playing fair here, those people would be heard from. And I recall the case of Libya. I remember that there was a bishop who spoke out very strongly and said, we function and live here as Christians with our Muslim brothers. We don't have an issue, but these people who are coming from the eastern part of the country, they mean to destroy us, and they did.
Yes.
And now, of course, you're covering Syria, and something different, though, has happened in Syria. When they left the Libya operation, there were so many, like the French leaders and Americans, all talked like, well, okay, Libya has now been brought into under our aegis, and so now we will do the same to Syria. They don't seem to have succeeded. Your reports seem to reflect a changing Syria, one which is getting stronger. Is that a correct impression?
Well, I mean, people are obviously, after 5 years of this foreign war in Syria, people are exhausted. And, like, I would say probably every family has lost somebody in their family or a close relative to the terrorism. But at the same time, they're steadfast and they believe in their army and in their government and their president. It has to be said, you know, the way that Western media and Gulf media would report on it. We know what they would say. But when you go to Syria or even when you talk with... There are Syrians in Canada I've spoken with about this. But anyway, the point is the vast majority of people not only support the president, but even love the president. And they say, look, he's not the problem. And most people recognize, at least by now, if not from the beginning, at least by now, they recognize the problem is this foreign war on Syria. And I actually had a chance to go to an interesting area of Syria, to the southeast of Damascus. It's called Sweida. It's known, you know, it's primarily when you hear a report on it, it's called the Druze area. But what I found interesting about Sweida was the people there. Now, I talked with somebody that was affiliated with the Minister of Tourism who was talking about businesses in Sweida and how development had actually been increasing in recent, in the past year or so. And the reason being that Syrians abroad had come back to Sweida to support, you know, development and to keep the, because the economy is really shattered by both this foreign war in Syria and by the sanctions, the criminal sanctions. So that was one interesting thing, is that there had been development in terms of like restaurants and cafes and even some hotels opening. But another really interesting thing was talking with average people and then talking with the head leader of the, like the sheikh, head leader of the Druze there. I got to speak with him, and he basically just, he gave me 20 minutes of his time, but he, you know, in 5 minutes, he summarized essentially what had happened, how Swedens had handled it, that they had recognized from the beginning what was going on, and they'd said no to this, and they'd said no to any sort of division, that they'd stood with the government. There had been some attempts to, you know, divide them, but they'd stood fast, and they defended Sweda from the beginning. And so that's what, one of the reasons I'm told that Sweda is actually fairly calm.
Mm-hmm.
But another interesting thing was coming back from Sweda from at nighttime. I went there by bus, but I came back by taxi because there were no buses in the evening. Mm-hmm. Coming back at night, the driver was just narrating. There's a long open stretch of road, and he said, you know, until, say, I can't remember the date, but say last year and prior years, this was a deadly section of road because it was known for kidnappings and for snipings and for landmines. But now, because of the greater presence of the Syrian Arab army, it was safer. But it was definitely very interesting to be traveling that road. And another interesting thing about that trip was that the bus that I took actually left from Jaramana. And a few days later, I'm sure you're aware of the Zionist assassination of a head. I'm blanking on his name. They assassinated a head resistance leader that was living in Jaramana,
mm-hmm.
Right in that area. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name at the moment, but he's well known.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I mean, all around us are these, this struggle for the fate of Syria seems to be having kind of ripple effect. One gets the impression that the Saudi extremist behavior now with executing 47 people in one day, it appears to be that they, one impression is one could get is that they are doubling down on their gamble to create sectarian warfare and to create havoc. Could you talk about do the Syrians that you spoke to, did they talk about what they think of Saudi Arabia and what they think is behind these attacks on them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, I would say even from when I first went there in April 2014, most Syrians are very aware. They call it the foreign plot on Syria, and they're aware of the Saudi, you know, the Mufti of Saudi Arabia and all their horrible sheikhs and their, 24/7 hate-speeching sectarian speech. They're very aware of it. And Mufti Hassoun, who I've had the honor of meeting twice now, who's, you know, Syria's grand religious leader, Grand Mufti, he had spoken about this, and he, you know, in contrast to the Saudi sectarianism that, you know, again, average Syrians know that this is coming from Saudi, from Qatar, and then they know of all these foreign fighters that have infiltrated thanks to Turkey and the Zionist entity. But Mufti Hassoun speaks of unity, and he's just like the perfect, he is like a perfect representative of Syrians in that the majority of Syrians that I've met and I've read about do not identify themselves along sectarian lines. They identify themselves primarily as Syrians, and then if you push them, which is considered rude, then they'll tell you what, you know, their faith is.
Mm-hmm.
So they do recognize that Saudi is behind this, and then, of course, Israel and America and Turkey are behind this. And I just wanted to say that the person, I can't believe I blanked on his name, but Samir Kuntar was the man that I was thinking of that was assassinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Also, you pointed out in the article, dissidentvoices.org, voice.org, these are mutually supportive communities. They sort of making it, they're going a little out of their way to show support for each other. For example, you interviewed a Muslim gentleman who said, "Well, I went to the Christmas at his home, and he comes to the mosque, visits the mosque." And that now you would once again, if we were to listen to the rhetoric from Washington and wherever, they always claim that's what they want, but that is not. What you can tell, as the old expression is, I hear what you say, but I see what you do. Instead of supporting that kind of life and culture lived by the Syrians, all the money and all the arms are going to Turkey and to Saudi Arabia. And what's your assessment? Also, when they talk about Turkey, is Turkey staying the course, or is it what do they think Turkey wants out of all this? Do you know?
You mean Syrians? What's Syrians?
Yeah, what the Syrian view of the Turkish role?
Oh, I mean, I don't know what they think Turkey wants out of it. They're very aware of Turkey's role in funneling terrorists in, and even, for example, in attacking Syria. Like, if you take the village of Kasab, which is in the north, like north of Latakia, and it's been attacked a number of times. But one of the major attacks, which occurred last year, Turkey. I mean, the residents of that village, who I got to meet in Latakia, they were. IDPs taking shelter in a church there, and they were saying the first shots came from Turkey. And that's just one incident. I met other people that live in areas very close to the border of Turkey, and they spoke of how the terrorists come back and forth. I mean, we know the American Lebanese journalist Serena Shim was documenting Turkey's involvement in funneling terrorists in before she had that suspicious car crash, which is most likely an assassination. Turkey has been very well documented in its role in supporting terrorists, and most Syrians are aware of this as well. And I think they would be, I mean, I guess the average person might be perplexed. I mean, if you don't think of whatever Erdogan wants to gain from this, they would be perplexed, like, why is this being done to us? We've done nothing to Turkey, you know. Mm-hmm. But, of course, there are many reasons why they want to. They've looted Syria of, well, I mean, a couple of years ago it was 1,500 factories, so I'd say it's much more than that by now. And they're gaining, they're profiting from Syria's destruction, and most Syrians are aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there are two villages, Fua and Kafaria. They're in the north, and you know, we were just talking about Syria's plurality and how they have eschewed this, like they've avoided this sectarianism. And these two villages are a prime example. And then when you look at mainstream media reporting on it, this is another prime example of the agenda to create sectarian strife, because the villages do have a predominant population of Shia, if I remember, mm-hmm. Alawi. But anyway, the point is that even though the villages are one particular faith, they've intermarried and they've had good relations with their Sunni and Christian neighbors. And I had many people from these villages who I talked with tell me this, you know, like, again, yes, we have different faiths, but we intermarry and we share each other's celebrations, and this sectarianism is foreign to us.
Yeah. Well, that's such an important message. And by the way, we are speaking to Eva Bartlett in gaza.wordpress.com, and her most recent article is in dissidentvoice.org. That was December 29th of 2015. You also you have lived with this issue, the Palestinians' question, and all the various in Gaza, the West Bank, et cetera. You've been following this for years. Now, it also not repeated often enough that Syria has a very large Palestinian refugee population, and it has been a kind of a burning issue as to what is happening to them. And the name of the camp that comes up is Yarmouk. Could you talk about how that is being resolved, what the status of that is?
Yeah, I mean, the Palestinian question in Syria is both simple and complex. Simple in that Palestinians from every Palestinian, I've met a number of Palestinians in Syria, and even those that have, for whatever reason, gone to Lebanon, have said, we had equal rights. The only thing they couldn't do was vote in the presidential elections, or, you know, the parliamentary presidential elections, but they had equal rights in terms of health care, work, education, etc. And they were treated just as Syrians were treated. There was no discrimination as you'd find in neighboring countries. Mm-hmm. That's one thing to note. The other thing to note is that corporate media and certain pro-Palestinian groups have used this issue, and used Yarmouk in particular, to divide people and to turn people against Syria. And for me, this is really painful, because I did, you know, I lived 3 years in Gaza and I spent time in the occupied West Bank. And so obviously anybody who sees the just cause that is Palestine, it's very painful to see that there are people who support Palestine but refuse to support Syria because they've been led astray mm-hmm. by propaganda such as what's been said about Yarmouk. So Yarmouk is an area that was over a million Syrians and about 200, there's differing reports, 170,000 to 200,000 Palestinians living in the same area. It's being dubbed a refugee camp, but most Syrians and Palestinians there would call it a neighborhood. And it was a neighborhood that actually people came to for shopping. It was known as a great shopping district. Mm-hmm. It was infiltrated by terrorists and eventually infiltrated by Daesh, ISIS. And obviously, if the terrorists, just like anywhere where the terrorists are, the Syrian army is waging, the government and army are fighting terrorism as they have the right to do so. But within Yarmouk, it's actually Palestinian forces that are fighting against the terrorists because it's supposed to be within Yarmouk, it's supposed to be under Palestinian security. Mm-hmm. So what's happened with this population, this massive population, has dwindled. I just went to Yarmouk. I was only able to enter a very little ways in because it was dusk and it was dangerous, and I was told by the security I was with, if we go any further, we can't protect you against the snipers because, mm-hmm. you know, there's only certain areas of the area, the district, that they can still control. Mm-hmm. What I was told when I met with the leadership there was that now, and I've heard this confirmed by an RT reporter as well, now there are at most 4,000 or 5,000 people in the Yarmouk district. Among them are terrorists and people who support terrorists, and among them people who, for whatever reason, have not left. Mm-hmm. But the Syrian government has, and it's worked with different aid agencies, Red Cross, UN, evacuated Syrians and Palestinians from that area over the years. And they've also enabled aid to get into the area, but it doesn't always work because often, and this is documented again, often the aid that is trying to get in, they are attacked by snipers, or if it gets in, and this is what people from there told me, the terrorist factions within will steal it, and then they'll sell it at extortionist rate, or maybe not sell it at all. So the whole blame has been pinned on the Syrian government, when in fact it isn't the fault of the Syrian government, and their strategy everywhere, even though Western leftists and the mainstream media would laugh at this, but the strategy everywhere has been to minimize casualties they go to great lengths to keep the minimum number of casualties, and there will be casualties because this is a war, they're fighting on terrorism. Mm-hmm. But they're not, I mean, the Ken Roths out there would have you believe that the Syrian army is just leveling entire areas mercilessly. And Ken Roth is a huge part of this problem. He lies consistently. He tweets images that are not in Syria. He's tweeted Gaza, Shajai, and he said this is Aleppo, this devastation, which was done by the Zionists in summer 2014. Ken Roth said this was done by the Syrian Arab Army, although he didn't say it like that, mm-hmm. on the people of Aleppo. So, you know, there's a lot of lies, and unfortunately the Palestinians are being used. But just on that note, I would recommend Sharmeen Nirwani's excellent article, Stealing Palestine, Who Dragged Palestinians into the Syria Conflict. Very thorough, and she talks about other areas in Syria where there's Palestinian camps and the role of different Palestinian factions in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Again, that's Sharmeen could you just repeat one?
Sharmeen Nirwani.
Yes.
If you just Google something like Stealing Palestine, Who Dragged the Palestinians into the Syrian Conflict.
Yeah. Well, I think she's doing great work and you're doing great work. We're so glad that you were there. And I urge everyone, please, it's Eva Bartlett, and it's in gaza.wordpress.com. And, of course, latest article is in dissidentvoice.org.
Do I have a moment just to mention
Please, absolutely.
Yeah, well, there's a district of Homs called the Zahra. Mm-hmm. And about a week before I went, it was hit by a triple bombing. It was essentially one car bomb, which was parked right next to a natural gas delivery truck, which caused the second bombing. And then some hours later, the terrorists came back and detonated a suicide vest. So that particular attack, the reports vary, but Syrian state news says 16 civilians were killed. Then I went to that area, and I met with some of the survivors, and I took some of their testimonies. And a week later, it was hit again. And this area has been repeatedly ravaged by terrorism over the years, and not just Zahra, but also Akrama School, like various areas, not just in Homs. But the point I wanted to make was this terrorism, you know, it's very deadly, just like the deadly mortar and rocket terrorism that hits Damascus and environments, Byron's and Latakia. And the West refuses to condemn it as terrorism. And that's the point I want to make, is that these are terrorist acts that are being enabled by us, by the West.
Yes.
And we're refusing to condemn these acts of terrorism.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Eva Bartlett, we really appreciate it. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you.
You're done. Bye-bye. Taylor Report, Facebook / The Taylor Report. And you can get the program on Thursdays, I'm absolutely sure. Terry, thank you very much, and we'll see you all next week.
Right here, right now. Every day, CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city. Woo! Toronto.